Hello, good morning, and welcome. We are on a bus tour of 250 years of church history, from the Protestant Reformation to the American Revolution. We are in Switzerland, but I'd like to summarize where we were last week. There was a lot more discussion, debate, and questions than I had expected. We were talking about baptism. There are three views of baptism. Christianity in the world today is divided into three different groups. There's the Eastern Orthodox, which historically came out of Constantinople, which is modern-day Istanbul. There's the Catholic Church, which is currently headquartered in Rome. And there is the Protestant denominations, right now headquartered at Village Seven Presbyterian Church. Every Christian church, whether it's Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, or Protestant, holds to the idea of believers' baptism, which is called credo, credo baptism. Credo is Latin for I believe. No matter what church you go to, anywhere in the world, whether you are 8 or 80, they will recommend that you get baptized if you've never been baptized before. With me so far? So all churches everywhere in the world hold to believers' baptism. If you make a decision and place your faith in Christ, they will recommend at that time that you get baptized if you've never been baptized before. Second view. All of Eastern Orthodox, all of Roman Catholic, and most Protestant denominations hold to infant baptism, or what's called paedobaptism. Paedo is the Greek word for child. What denominations of the Protestant part of Christianity hold to this? Well, the Lutherans will do infant baptism. Reformed traditions will do it. So that means any church that has the word reformed in it. Presbyterian churches do infant baptism. Anglican churches do infant baptism. Episcopalian, which is the American version of that, and Methodists all do infant baptism. And as we discussed last week, for Ulrich Zwingli, this was a parallel of the Old Testament practice of circumcising male members of the tribe when they were 8 days old. Did this make them a believer? No. Did they choose to get baptized? No. So he drew and wrote about a parallel between that and infant baptism. With Jewish circumcision, it did not make you a believer, but it made you part of the community of faith. It made you an MOT, member of the tribe. So you're now part of that community of faith. In the same way, infant baptism makes you a member of the church, but not a communing member, meaning you don't take communion. With me so far? There's a third view. The third view, held by a minority of the number of denominations in Protestantism, is believers-only baptism, also called credo baptism only. And that is the idea that we don't baptize babies, we only baptize people after they profess faith in Christ, that they're a believer. Who holds to this idea? Well, last week we looked at the Anabaptists, and they held to the idea of only believers' baptism, no children's baptisms, no baby baptisms. And we discussed the fact that this broke the franchise. Back then, if you were baptized as a baby, you became a member of the church and a member of the city. if you didn't get baptized, you were not a member of the church and you were not a citizen of the city in Zurich. So the groups that hold to that would be the Anabaptists, the Baptists, non-denominational people, and Pentecostals in modern day, the modern day world. Why, though, is it so prevalent in the United States that people hold to believers' baptism only? Glad you asked. The answer is, this is Pew Research, and this research is 10 years old. If you look at the non-denominational people who go to church, it's more than half of the Protestants. If you look at the Southern Baptists alone, that's this blue group here. Then there's the American Baptists. So if you add up all the Baptists, it's at least two-thirds of the Protestant Christians in America hold to the idea of believers' baptism only. But historically, that hasn't been the case. So I wanted to summarize that before we jump into our lesson today. Any questions before I proceed? Yes.
Bill, the Catholics believe
it depends on when in history that occurred. Let me explain what I mean by that. Yeah, if you did it yesterday, it means something different than what it means tomorrow. No, what it means is there was a time when people held to the idea of baptismal regeneration, that when you were baptized, you were clean of all sins, you are innocent. That is why at some periods of history, and I've used the example of Constantine, the first Christian Roman emperor, he got baptized about a month before he died. So that way it took care of all the sins in his life. And he just made sure he led a clean life the last month or so. There are others who still hold to baptismal regeneration in that it makes you innocent. Doesn't make you perfect, it makes you innocent, but doesn't save you. That view has been held throughout the medieval period. I don't know that that's true of the Roman Catholic Church today. I quit studying the Roman Catholic Church after the Protestant Reformation occurred. Okay, let's jump into our lesson. What's that? Yes, goes back that far. By the end of today's session, you should be able to describe John Calvin's life and distinctives, demonstrate the philosophical origins of Presbyterianism. Presbyterianism, as we know it today, came out of Scotland. You'll find out why. And then enumerate Calvin's contributions, if we get that far. If you'd like to learn more, if you'd like to read more, July is when John Calvin's birthday is, and I wrote an article on the history of John Calvin. It's at billpetra.com, History of John Calvin. You might also want to read the article on the history of the King James Bible. Why? Because the predominant popular English Bible was the Geneva Bible that was translated in Geneva. John Calvin's brother-in-law led that effort, and John Knox from Scotland helped him. But the Puritans, when James I became King of England, they asked for a number of reforms in the church. He ignored them all, but they asked him if he would allow them to do a translation of the Bible into English, translated in England. And that became known as the King James Bible. Puritans didn't like it, but we'll talk about them when we get to the Puritans. Okay, here we are, Switzerland. Last week, we talked about Ulrich Zwingli, the pastor of the Grossmünster, the big church, right on the Limmat River in Zurich. Today, we're moving to Geneva. Zurich speaks Schweizerdeutsch, Swiss German. Geneva speaks Francais, right across the border from France. So, Ulrich Zwingli lived in the northeast German canton. Calvin lived in the west amongst French-speaking Swiss. The Italian-speaking Swiss, they never saw the Reformation. Germany has a monarchy. So Charles V is the Holy Roman Emperor of Germany and other parts, Roman Catholic. Switzerland is a democracy, at least on paper, and it's governed by the city fathers. If you could convince the city fathers of your particular view on religion, that city, that canton, would become Protestant. The Swiss were fiercely independent people since the time of William Tell. It was renowned for its mercenaries. It would rent out its soldiers to go fight foreign wars. Here's John Calvin, the genius of Geneva. If Luther was the beginner of the Reformation, Calvin was the systemizer. This is 26 years after Calvin. So he is a second-generation reformer. He's born 26 years after Calvin. Question? I'm sorry, Luther. So Calvin's born in 1609. Luther's born in 1483. So is Zwingli. They're only 7 weeks apart in 1483. He has been called the savior of the Reformation. We talked about the fact that the two sacraments of the Lord's Supper and baptism, you would think would have unified all of the Protestants. It didn't. Calvin helped resolve that issue. So he's called the savior of the Reformation. He's the greatest of all the reformers in terms of his impact and influence worldwide throughout history. Now, there's a perception of Luther that he was strong, stalwart, muscular, with a centurion voice who desired to consign people to hell. I had a professor when I was at Berkeley. His parents, when he was in high school, his parents wanted him to go to Calvin College. He didn't really care for Calvin, but World War II happened. He comes back from the war. The GI Bill allowed him to go to Harvard. He got a doctorate in Renaissance history. But one of his great desires was to teach a class not just on the Renaissance, but the entire spread of church history. So he taught a year-long class in the history of Christianity, and I went to the first class. And then I sat in a couple of other times. The last time I saw him, I went to his office, and his desk was covered by 3x5 cards with notes in French and Latin. And he was writing a book called John Calvin, A 16th Century Portrait. This is the picture from the cover of that book. I don't recommend this book to you. Even the introduction has footnotes. It's pretty academic stuff. But everyone has to wrestle with Calvin. People may not agree with Calvin. Historians may not like him, but they have to wrestle with John Calvin. Now, it turns out that this view of Calvin was completely wrong. He was humble. He was quiet. He was conflict avoidance. Luther would run to an argument, and if there wasn't one happening, he'd start one. Calvin avoided those things. He rarely expressed himself in the first person. He rarely wrote I. His reticence has contributed to the perception of him as a cold, intellectual, humanly unapproachable guy. But his thought has been interpreted as abstract and concerned with timeless issues. He wrote about the classics, but those who knew him knew that he was very different. They remarked on his talent for friendship, but also that he could have a hot temper. And when he picked up his pen, he could slay giants. He systematized the Reformation. Luther wrote tons of things, but he never wrote a systematic theology. Calvin did. It's called the Institutes of the Christian Religion. Wherever you study Calvin, it elicits strong reactions. Let me give you just a few quotes from history. This is Ernst Renan. He was a French historian. Calvin was the most Christian man of his age. Montesquieu, who was an 18th century philosopher, said Genevans should bless the birthday of Calvin. And so in July, you can bless his birthday by reading my article. Theodore Beza, who was Calvin's successor in Geneva, I've been a witness of him for 16 years. In this man, there was exhibited to all an example of the life and death of the Christian, such as it will not be easy to deprecate, and it will be difficult to imitate John Calvin. Wow, that's pretty impressive. Wait, one more. John Knox, who was one of his students and a Scottish reformer, said Geneva is the most perfect school of Christ since the days of the apostles. So when John Knox fled from England during the persecutions of Bloody Mary, who was the Queen of England, he was one of the last Protestants to leave. She had killed 360 Protestant leaders. So he finally leaves and he goes to Geneva and he studies under Calvin. Very impressed. Now, there are other views of Calvin. Jimmy Swaggart said that Calvin has caused untold millions of souls to be damned. So, take that for what it's worth. The Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church says Calvin was the cruel and unopposed dictator of Geneva. Thank you. Voltaire was a French Enlightenment philosopher, early 1700s, said Calvin raised himself up to the ranks of the Pope of the Protestants. Thomas Jefferson, you may have heard of him. Calvin introduced more absurdities into the Christian religion than can readily be imagined. Thank you very much. All right, here's what you need to understand about John Calvin and his role in Switzerland. And that's the equation 1 + 1 = 1. What do I mean by that? If you add Zurich Reformation to the Geneva Reformation, that was called the Reformed tradition. So the Swiss tradition, Zurich and Geneva, became known as the Reformed tradition. So Zwingli plus Calvin equals Calvinism. As we discussed, Zwinglianism would be more difficult to pronounce. All of this ultimately led to Presbyterianism. Yay! But it led to a number of other Reformed denominations as well. In review, Luther and his successor Melanchthon gave us Lutheranism. It was the first of the Protestant traditions. If you go to Germany, you don't go to a Lutheran church. You go to an evangelical church. That's how you identify Protestant churches in Germany. Their form of government is episcopal. They have bishops and priests, hierarchical. Zwingli and Bullinger in Zurich give us the German-Swiss tradition combined with Calvin and his successor, Theodore Beza, gave us the French-Swiss tradition, combined became known as Reformed. Their form of government was Presbyterian, elders who were elected by the congregation to represent them. Scottish Presbyterianism comes from that, and Dutch Reform. Last week, we looked at Grebel, Mons, and Simons, the Swiss Brethren and the Anabaptist movement, congregational forms of government. Mennonites, English Separatist, English Baptist came out of that. Let me introduce you to Jehan or Jean Covin. It was not unusual to spell your name in a number of different ways back then. Ulrich Zwingli had lots of spellings of his name. He was born on July 10th, 1509, and he was born in Noyon, which is in the province of Picardy, up about 60 miles northeast of Paris. He was the middle of three sons. His father was a professional. He was a church. Though both his father and one of his brothers later got excommunicated. That was fun. Alvin was educated by the church on the equivalent of a football scholarship. So you go to college, you don't really have to study. But he did. So he had a church position and a salary, John Calvin, from the time he was 12 years old. He went to several schools. He went to Collège Réal, which was where he studied theology. His father wanted him to go into the church. So Collège Réal was where he studied theology. Then he went to the University of Orléans. His father said, you know, studying law would be a really good idea. Calvin wasn't really that interested in it, but to please his father, he did go to the University of Orléans. But he studied law, he studied humanism. But when his father died, he wasn't really that interested in law, so he went to the University of Bourges, where he studied the classics. That means he would study Greek and Latin classic works, one of which was Seneca. So Seneca was born almost the same year as Christ. He was a Stoic philosopher in Rome. Stoicism is really popular nowadays, especially amongst computer programs. They just love Stoicism, but they don't read Seneca as much as they read Marcus Aurelius, who was played by Richard Harris in The Gladiator, right? Okay. So here's what's interesting. He publishes a legal commentary on Seneca's essay on clemency. And Seneca, when he grew up, he became tutor to the Emperor Nero when Nero was young. And Seneca said to him, it is important for a Roman emperor to be virtuous. And he wrote a treatise, probably dedicated to Nero, called De Clementia, which means on the topic of mercy. A ruler should be merciful. It didn't go that way with Nero, but so Luther studies the law, goes into the church, becomes a monk. Calvin studies theology, ultimately studies law. He was brilliant. They called him the accusative case. One, because he would accuse people and argue a lot. But the second is, if you know Greek or Latin, one of the case endings is called accusative. Nominative, genitive, dative, accusative. So it's an inside joke amongst those at the university. So he studied Latin, he studied Greek, he studied Hebrew. He was converted around 1532-33. He doesn't mention it for 25 years. Doesn't talk about how he was converted until he wrote a commentary on the Book of Psalms. And he talks about it 25 years later. God drew me from obscure and lowly beginnings and conferred on me the most honorable office of herald and minister of the gospel. My father had intended me for theology from an early age, but when he reflected that a career in law proved everywhere very lucrative for its practitioners, the prospect suddenly made him change his mind. And so it happened that I was called away from study of out of obedience to my father's wishes, and I tried to work hard, yet God at last turned my course in another direction. By the secret reign of his providence. What happened first was that by an unexpected conversion, he tamed teachableness, a mind too stubborn for its years. For I was so strongly devoted to the superstitions of the papacy, meaning he was a very devout Roman Catholic, that nothing could draw me from such depths of mire. And so this mere taste of true godliness that I received set me on fire with such a desire to progress that I pursued the rest of my studies more coolly, meaning law, although I did not give them up altogether. Before a year had slipped away, anyone who longed for a purer doctrine kept on coming to me, still a beginner, a raw recruit. 25 years later, he writes his testimony. So he has his conversion then, and Nicholas Kopp is a close friend of his at the Collège Royal. And Nicholas expressed in a public sermon at the beginning of the term things that Calvin probably wrote that sounded very evangelical. They sounded very much like Lutheran Protestantism. Well, the Roman Catholic Church didn't like that, so Kopp fled Paris, and soon after, so did John Calvin. So he goes into exile. He left France for Strasbourg. Strasbourg's on the border. It's right on the Rhine River. It's on the border between France and Germany. Back then, it was Germany. It's changed countries six times since the 1880s. It changed again in World War II. The Germans had conquered it, and then the Allies took it again. So he leaves for Strasbourg, but he grieved for his motherland of France all his life. Traveled under three assumed names, dressed as a common gardener. That was him, conflict avoidance. He studied in Basel, in Strasbourg, and Italy. He was writing. In Strasbourg and Basel, he writes the first edition of one of the most important books in modern Christendom. It's called Institutes of the Christian Religion. He's 27 years old when he writes this. I tried reading it when I was 27 years old. I had a hard time getting through it. It's very good. It is essentially a systematic theology, although Calvin would have called it a biblical theology. So he ultimately ends up in Italy. He's a wandering evangelist in Italy. Now, why would a man who believes in predestination go out and share the gospel? We're commanded to. Any other reasons? Absolutely. God uses means and God uses people. We don't know who God preordained for salvation. God told us to preach to everyone. All right. He comes back to France to visit his parents from Strasbourg. And then after he visits them, he's heading back to Strasbourg. But he has a providential meeting. He has a detour because a war is going on between Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, Germany, and France, Francis I. So there's this war going on along the border there. And so rather than going straight to Strasbourg, he goes down and around through Geneva, and he spends the night in Geneva, one night only. And then he's going to proceed north to Strasbourg. While he's there, he is recognized by Guillaume Farrell, Will Farrell, not the comedian. This is a guy who's 20 years older than he is, but he's read the Institutes of the Christian Religion. He knows who Calvin is. And so he goes up to Calvin, and he's been working in Geneva. William Farrell's been working in Geneva for 4 years, sharing the gospel. He's a thundering, fiery evangelist. Farrell had read the Institutes, met Calvin, tried to persuade him to help him with the Reformation in Geneva. Calvin says, no, I am writing in Strasbourg. I have my books. Leave me alone. William Farrell says, God has from heaven laid his hand upon you, and the wrath of God will fall upon you, and all your works will become nothing if you don't stay in Geneva and help me.
Is that a threat?
Calvin said, this arrested me. He writes later, Farrell, who burned with an extraordinary zeal to advance the gospel, immediately strained every nerve, and after having learned that my heart was set upon devoting myself to private studies, for which I wished to keep myself free from other pursuits, and finding that he gained nothing by his entreaties, he proceeded to utter an imprecation that God would curse my retirement and tranquility of the studies which I sought, if I should withdraw and refuse to give assistance when the necessity in Geneva was so great. By this imprecation, I was so stricken with terror that I desisted from my journey that I had undertaken. So, John Calvin heard from William Farrell, and it changed his life, and it changed our lives. Discussion. Calvin heard in Farrell's word the voice of God. Do you have someone in your life that is like that? So, Geneva was a town of about 10,000 people at this time. Through the work of Calvin and Farrell, it grew to 25,000 people. Refugees from all over Europe, Protestant refugees, came to Geneva from Spain, from France, from Italy. The town is a little bit larger today, about 175,000 people. The Reformation was in trouble in Geneva. Protestantism had only had the shallowest of roots, and nearby cardinals, Roman Catholic cardinals, were putting pressure on them. So the city council offered Calvin a position, professor of sacred scripture, and he began his work with vigor. He prepared a confession of faith that everyone in the city needed to accept if they wanted to become a citizen. He wrote the articles concerning the government of the church. He planned an educational program for all. He insisted that the church has the power of excommunication. Back then, the city magistrate had the power of excommunication. But he argued that the church leadership, particularly expulsion from the Lord's table, it's one of the steps in discipline, for those who did not conform to spiritual standards, whether they were Christian or not. So, as I mentioned before, if someone was excommunicated, Calvin said, I expect to see you Sunday morning in church because you need the gospel. So the Reformed tradition does not ban or shun people who are excommunicated. It was not well received. There were a lot of people. There was a group called the Libertines, translated sinners. People who like to dance and drink and those kinds of things, because the knee that bows to dance cannot bow to prayer. Anyway, Calvin would argue against them. There were people who didn't want to agree to the articles concerning the government of the church. They didn't want to subscribe to the confession, and he was kicked out. What? Calvin was kicked out of Geneva along with William Farrell. And he goes into exile. The exile is in exile. And he goes to Strasbourg. This is Notre Dame de Strasbourg. It's very, very famous. That is not where he preached. You'll notice that only one of the towers was finished. They ran out of money. Anyway, this is where he preached. He preached in four or five churches to French refugees in Germany. Strasbourg is Germany at this time. So I was there about 6 months ago, took a picture of St. Nicholas Church. It had been Catholic, then it became Lutheran, then it became Calvinistic. Then it became Anglican, and now it's a charismatic church. In fact, Albert Schweitzer, after he completed his theological studies, he served as a curate at this church. How exciting, before he went to Africa. While he was there, Melanchthon, the successor of Martin Luther in Wittenberg, is there at the home of Martin Bucer. And Martin Bucer had a very hospitable home. He and his wife welcomed Protestant preachers. So Melanchthon is there, Calvin is there. And Calvin was deep in thought, and Melanchthon says, well, it seems to me that our theologue is thinking about a future wife. Now, Calvin wasn't. I, who have the air of being so hostile to celibacy, I am still not married and do not know if I ever will be. If I take a wife, it will be because of being better freed from numerous worries, I can devote myself to the Lord. Calvin was living with his sisters. It was kind of a mess. Idelet de Boer knew Calvin from Geneva. She and her husband were Anabaptists, and Calvin would argue with them in Geneva. They left Geneva and moved to Strasbourg ahead of Calvin. But while they're in Strasbourg, Idelet's husband dies. And Martin Bucer, he died from the plague. Martin Bucer says to Calvin, why not consider Idelet? She was a widow. She was a woman of strong character. She was attractive, intelligent, and had a quiet strength. Calvin asked William Farrell to come and marry them, and he did. They were both so sick after they got married that Calvin wrote later, we did not have an overjoyous honeymoon. But after he got well, he would often go to church conferences. He was away more often than he was at home. But Calvin called her my faithful helper, the faithful helper of my ministry, the best companion of my life. Although they had three children together, none of them survived infancy. But she had children from her first marriage. And when she died, Calvin adopted the children and raised them as his own. And he never really recovered from her death. But it gave him the opportunity to write to other pastors all over Europe who had lost their mate and encourage them. He had quite a ministry. Anyway, but before she died, after two or three years in Strasbourg, things are not going well in Geneva. And so they ask him to come back. He said, I would rather submit to death 100 times than to that cross on which I had to perish daily 1,000 times over when I was in Geneva. They said, look, if you come, we will give you a fine house with a garden. We will furnish the house. We will give you a velvet robe trimmed in fur. Oh. And we will send a 2-horse carriage to pick up you and Idelet and the children and move you back to Geneva. Then he got a letter from William Farrell saying, you need to go back to Geneva. And so he did. He was now in a much stronger position. The town council enacted his ecclesiastical ordinances, which they refused previously. It provided for religious education of the townspeople, especially children. He wrote psalms. A psalter is a book of psalms that you sing. He wrote some of those songs. Wonderful man. He undertook a wide variety of reforms for the city against the superstition of Roman Catholicism, sexual immorality, the regulation of taverns, measures against dancing, gambling, swearing. And these were put in place by the town council. He came up with a systematic discipline among the citizens, and he wrote against the Anabaptists. He differed with Luther on some things, which we'll talk about later. And let me close with this. He proposed church officers, four different kinds of men who would serve, pastors and teachers. They were called doctors. So the pastors would preach the scriptures. The doctors would instruct in theology, church history. So I would be a doctor. Then elders who were laymen, they were elected by the congregation, kind of a representative form of government. Ooh, what a novel idea. And were to be attendant to the spiritual and moral needs of the congregation. Deacons were to attend to the charitable responsibilities of people, the physical needs. And together they would meet in what's called a consistory of pastors and elders to make all aspects of Genevan life conform to the Bible. We have something like that today. It's called a session. And that's where all the elders, all the ruling elders, and all the teaching elders, the pastors, get together. And every once in a while, we get together with the deacons as well. It's kind of fun. All right. This is Geneva. This is Le Jet, the jet. And up on the mountain, in the old city, you can see Saint-Pierre, St. Peter's. That's where Calvin preached. And that's where we'll pick it up next week.